Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we revisit how privatization of militaries is compromising international conduct and affecting international law and ethics. In remembering Amy Eckert, who passed away this week, she is the author of Outsourcing War, Just War Tradition in the Age of Military Privatization. And first, the difficulties of life under military occupation and a pandemic for the people of Kashmir.
The COVID-19 pandemic has upended lives of people all over the world. The sense of powerlessness, the fear of infection, has alienated people regardless of political situation. But in areas of conflict and of military and political occupation, populations are even more at risk. On today's show, we explore life under the pandemic in one conflict area, the contested provinces of Jammu and Kashmir in India. Our guest is Mona Bhan, Ford Maxwell Professor of South Asian Studies and Associate Professor of Anthropology at Syracuse University. She is the author of Counterinsurgency, Development, and the Politics of Identity, From Warfare to Welfare, which examines the relationship between everyday forms of militarization and social life in Kashmir. Professor Bhan, my first question to you is, what exactly is the status of Kashmir? Is it under occupation? Who controls it, etc.?
I have been working in the part of Kashmir that is under Indian occupation, and that's what I'll be mostly focused on today. So to preface, right, the story of COVID and how it's impacted populations or worsened their state under military siege, I do want to maybe start from August 5th of last year, 2019, when the right-wing Hindu supremacist government under Narendra Modi, belongs to the Bharatiya Janata Party or the BJP, initiated a multi-pronged military assault for the final and complete annexation of the portion of Kashmir which is occupied by India. Now, just to again track it back a little bit and to recognize that the word annexation, of course, is also used historically for the political condition in Kashmir, because from 1947 onwards for Kashmiris, they have been living under an active military occupation. And that is so because when India got its independence in 1947 from the British, Kashmir was a princely state at the time, a Muslim majority state governed by a Hindu monarch. And India's condition at the time, because of the ongoing political uncertainty, war, and post-colonial border making, what the king had to do was provisionally accede to India at the time. And I can go into details perhaps later if we have time. But it was a provisional accession of Kashmir with India. It was not a full and final accession. And the condition, of course, was that eventually the people of Kashmir would be able to exercise the UN-mandated right to self-determination to figure out what they wanted to do politically, what side they wanted to be on, and so on and so forth. So at the time, because of certain, again, ongoing political uncertainties, and because of this provisional accession, a very important constitutional provision called Article 370 and Article 335A, there were two constitutional provisions that were included in the Indian Constitution to mark Kashmir's conditional and provisional accession to India. But again, let me reiterate, this was conditional, this was provisional. So what 370 essentially did was preserve to an extent Kashmir's semi-autonomous status within the Indian constitution, which meant that Kashmir, of course, could have its own flag, which it did until last year when 370 was abrogated. That is the story I'm trying to tell you, is the story of 370's abrogation on August 5th of last year. So Kashmiris had a separate flag. They had a separate constitution. They were the ones who could decide questions of citizenship and belonging and property rights and so on and so forth. All of that was to a large extent determined by the J&K or Jammu and Kashmir Constituent Assembly. Now, what the Indian government did on August 5th of last year was abrogate Article 370 and Article 35A, both of which, as I said, lent a degree of autonomy to Kashmiri state within the Indian Union. Now, the way this abrogation happened is also something that is very important to understand the ongoing COVID story in Kashmir, because according to many constitutional experts, this abrogation was deceitful. It was done unilaterally without taking into account people's aspirations or their wishes. In fact, on the contrary, there was an immediate militarized lockdown that was imposed on Kashmir. There was a total unprecedented communications blackout, which means people weren't able to make phone calls. I have family there. We weren't able to get in touch with them for months on end. There was no internet. People couldn't access cable TV. There were no newspapers being published. There was like this complete suppression of this fundamental right to express and speak and communicate even. So that, as I said, that was imposed on August 5th of last year. And in fact, it's a lockdown that has continued since under different iterations, right? So from March onwards, now if you see what's been happening in India, Modi imposed a massive, again, sort of overnight lockdown that terribly impacted particularly the lower classes of India, migrant laborers in particular. And we might have you might have heard stories about that. But for Kashmiris, in some ways, the lockdown was nothing unique. They had already been living in a lockdown. Mm-hmm. So it was this lockdown in a lockdown situation, sustained lockdown, where time just had stopped, literally, right? Mm-hmm. It was a static notion of time that one day passes into the next, but people can't really track or keep track of what day is what they're supposed to do with time and space and so on and so forth. So all of that, right, this kind of deep sense of siege that Kashmiris had been living in has only intensified, I would argue, with the most recent interventions of the Modi government at the behest now of a public health intervention. But I can go on and on. I'd like to talk a little bit more about what this public health intervention does, or how it sort of pans itself out, and how this is really part of India's counterinsurgency toolkit yet again.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I know, you know, part of what you're describing is that there's been this pattern where India's relationship with Kashmir has changed over the course of the last, particularly about a year or so ago, because it was last August, mm-hmm. that they had changed the constitutional status that you had described. And so this ongoing pattern of Indian military presence, which has always been in Kashmir, but has intensified over the course of the last year. But you mentioned counterinsurgency, because I know the context that the Indian government has stated as the justification for these actions was an increase of violence coming out of the region, including the killing of Indian soldiers, and there were military exchanges between India and Pakistan. So are you asserting they're using the pandemic as a justification to continue this practice, or is it just because, I mean, India has locked down all throughout the country and have had these really aggressive steps towards dealing with the pandemic, which certainly mirrors what they had been doing in Kashmir prior to March, you know, prior to the pandemic's outbreak.
Thanks, Doug. Actually, I would argue it's not necessarily business as usual continuity. It is, in fact, a rupture of some kind, because it's not so much that what the Indian government is doing is just stabilizing, right, its counterinsurgency interventions in Kashmir or, you know, perfecting them even more. It's worse than that. So under this current lockdown, again, at the behest of a public health crisis, there are some deep-rooted legal changes that are being introduced apart from, you know, the abrogation of 35A and 370 that happened last year. On April 1st of this year, soon after actually the lockdown, the Indian, the BJP government passed certain new domicile laws, which Kashmiris worry, and rightly so, they worry that these domicile laws, and I'll explain in a second what those are, that they really pave the way for India's settler colonial project in the region. And it's a Hindu settler colonial project. Again, to remind our audience that this is a Muslim majority region, the only Muslim majority region in that part of the world, I mean, in India. And the attempt here by the right-wing Hindu supremacist government is to, you know, open up the floodgates for outsiders, for non-Kashmiris to come in and settle down, buy property, and use whatever institutional rights or institutional privileges that were reserved for Kashmiris up until now because of 370 opened the floodgates for that to Indians too. So for example, there are new categories of citizens now coming up in the region. So the idea is to make non-Kashmiris eligible for school admissions, for employment, people who've lived there for 15 years, non-Kashmiris who've lived there for 15 years, grant them citizenship, make them Kashmiri, people who've studied there for 7 years, grant them rights to be Kashmiri, and so on and so forth. And so far, thousands of people have already been issued these domicile certificates under a pandemic. And this is really, really important to recognize that, as I said earlier, what we're recognizing is an intensification of this war against Kashmiris. Certainly, there are continuities, but there are ruptures and deep ones at that, both, you know, instrumentalized through political and legal means. And domicile law becomes one way to do so.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. We're discussing the pandemic under occupation and the specific case of Jammu and Kashmir. One thing that certainly seems to have changed over the years in Kashmir was, you know, for the longest time, this was an area that was described as, you know, Pakistan's demand that it become a part of Pakistan. We call it irredentist movement. But I know that polls started really demonstrating about 10 years ago that Kashmiris had begun rejecting the idea of irredentism with Pakistan in favor of independence. Is this shift within Kashmir one of the motivations, do you think, why India has taken a more aggressive step towards the region?
I wish I could have a straight up response to this question. The political reality on the ground in Kashmir is way more complicated. And I would say this, and I say it with most candor, that what Kashmiris really want right now is a right to self-determination, right? We haven't been able to figure out what that actually looks like. You know, it could potentially mean independence for large swaths of the population, or it could also potentially mean that some people genuinely want to be with Pakistan, because Pakistan has been a political party to this international issue now for the longest time, for the last 50 years, or sorry, more than 50 years, since 1947. So I think I kind of want to approach your question a bit differently and say that, you know, every time Kashmiris have wanted their right to self-determination, there are a lot of left-leaning liberals also in India who are okay with Kashmiris exercising their right of self-determination if they only seek independence. You know, the moment they say that there is perhaps a constituency in Kashmir who might want to align with Pakistan, there's suddenly this sort of a wall that is erected, that comes up, and people don't want to recognize that aspiration as a legitimate one. Now, we don't know. I mean, this is a very premature question, because I think for any movement to figure out, you know, what that goal is, we also have to remember that India has left Kashmiris very little options to dialogue, to create this dialogue around what right of self-determination could potentially look like. So, for example, Kashmiri leaders, not just leaders who supported, who were client regimes, they've been in prison for a long time. They were in prison for a long time after August 5th. But I'm talking about leaders who stood for Kashmiri's right to self-determination. They have been imprisoned repeatedly, right? The leadership is being kind of decimated in Kashmir. And so to expect them to know exactly what people want and whether they're going to align with Pakistan or seek independence, I think those are important questions. But I think what we really need to stress on right now is how Kashmiris have been denied their right to self-determination, whatever that might lead to. I mean, we cannot let those responses cloud the fundamental right that a population has to determine their future. We're just giving them sort of, you know, pick the right one. We can't do that. We can't do that. Especially, as I said, at a time when Kashmiris have been, their leadership is being decimated, imprisoned, silenced for years on end. Does that somehow respond to your question?
Absolutely. You know, this question, you know, similar in, you know, other contested areas, like, for instance, in Palestine, that will give you the right to choose so long as you make the right choice.
Choice.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Is there any reporting coming out about the number of cases in the region? Is this a region that has suffered quite a bit as a result of the pandemic?
Yes, immensely, in fact. And that's, again, going back to the militarized lockdown of the last year, because a lot of people are now saying it very openly and saying it clearly, you know, on social media, but also in other forms of media, that what this militarized lockdown did of the past year is minimize people's capacities, right? Institutional capacities, physical capacities, psychological capacities, social capacities to deal with a pandemic of this nature, right? And we still have a continued internet ban in Kashmir. Kashmiris are only able to access 2G internet, not 4G internet. And doctors are saying they're unable to download videos, important information, materials that they need to stay on top of recent research that's being done in this area. They're unable to meet with their patients, you know, online. So the word decimation, I think, is important here. It is literally a decimation of people's capacities to fight against a virus of this kind, against a pandemic of this kind within a militarized lockdown. And what's also been happening is, as I said, COVID is being used as a way to criminalize populations yet again. And the numbers are rising. It's at an alarming rate, I would argue. I mean, in the beginning, there was some sort of a pause or some kind of the number, because also there was no testing. There's no universal testing in India. So I really, of course, don't trust the numbers that are coming from India more broadly. But in Kashmir, the situation is worsening. Yesterday, I was talking to somebody from Kashmir, and in just the neighborhood that my family is in, they had recorded 100 infections. And this is like a upper middle class neighborhood of Kashmir, where people are generally slightly better off. So I just can't even imagine the state, you know, public health state in this region, where, of course, there's so much pressure already on medical resources, on medical personnel, pressures of multiple kinds. There are doctors who can't even say that they don't have facilities because they're immediately criminalized. So it's also that situation where doctors without facilities cannot, of course, ask for rights and ask for things as citizens, because they're not citizens, they're repressed subjects.
Thank you very much. This is a reminder that pandemics do not exist, do not outbreak in isolation, that there are political contexts, social contexts, and challenges that the populations face. Thank you very much, Mona Bond. Our guest has been Mona Bond. She is the Ford Maxwell Professor of South Asian Studies and Associate Professor of Anthropology at Syracuse University. She is the author of Counterinsurgency, Development, and the Politics of Identity, From Warfare to Welfare. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Doug.
When we come back, the effects of privatizing militaries, in a tribute to political scientist Amy Eckert, who studied how privatization of military compromised international conduct and affected law and ethics. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. To honor scholar Amy Eckert, who passed away this week, we are re-airing an interview we did with her about privatization of the military and how that has affected international conflict, law, and ethics. And first, Doug Becker remembers his friend and colleague.
These have been trying times for all of us. This week, it became even more difficult for me personally as I wakened yesterday to news that my good friend and colleague, Amy Eckert, passed away suddenly. Amy had been a guest on the show several times. Hers was an important voice in the international studies community. She had earned both a PhD and a JD and used her background in philosophy and law to advance our understanding of morality and law in modern warfare. In particular, she focused on newly emerging war practices, such as the use of automated weapons, such as drones, and the use of private military corporations by states in conflicts. She was wrestling with what these new developments meant for traditional Western discourse on what we call just war theory. Both how we conceptualize the justified use of force, what we call jus ad bellum, and the practices of war are jus in bello. One of the pieces she wrote called Outsourcing War is what we will replay today in honor of her work. But her passions were vast. She was dedicated in particular to two specific causes, the humanitarian impact of warfare and the welfare of cats. This is why her most passionate project was publicizing the work and commitment of Mohammed Al-Jalil, the so-called Catman of Aleppo. His work with Ernesto Cat Sanctuary, saving the cats caught in the middle of that horrible conflict in Syria, captured the world's attention in a BBC video in 2016. It moved Amy. She kept all of us updated as to his narrative and raised awareness and money to help him and his cats. This represented how she viewed conflict, where attention should be on those caught in the crossfire. They had no political or economic stake in the conflict. They were just trying to survive it. War destroys, regardless of technology used, and Amy wanted us all to remember this. She was thrilled that he was able to return to Aleppo and is currently working saving both cats and children in that war-torn city. He represents the human and feline spirit of survival, dedication, and rebirth. If Amy could have adopted every cat without a home, she would have. Instead, she found this incredible cat at a cat cafe near her home in Colorado. Truman was an older cat that had difficulty finding a home because it was suspected that he was HIV positive, FIV positive. Amy took him home and made him an internet star, at least among those of us who were her friends. Nothing captures Amy's heart quite like Truman's story and the way he thrived living with her. When she passed, her friends immediately inquired about Truman, who was going to take care of him, and to make sure that Truman found another good home. They knew that's what Amy would have wanted. On July 30th, 2020, Professor Amy Eckert of Metropolitan State University of Denver passed away. The international studies community lost a colleague. I lost a dear friend. She will be missed.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Over the past decades, private military contractors have grown to unprecedented levels, a change that has challenged the standing ethical doctrine known as just war theory, according to our next guest. Amy Eckert is with us. She is professor of political science at the Metropolitan State University of Denver, where she teaches and studies international ethics and international law. Her books include The Future of Just War, Rethinking the 21st Century, and her latest, Outsourcing War, the Just War Tradition in the Age of Military Privatization. Welcome, Amy Eckert. It's great to have you back here on the Scholar Circle.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be back.
Perhaps we should start how you started the book, which was with this vignette related to the Colombian rebel group, the FARC, and the U.S. citizens that it had captured. What happened there, and what does it signal?
It was really a perplexing scenario. There were three Americans who were held ultimately for about 5 years by the FARC in Colombia after their plane had crashed and they were captured. And really the puzzling thing about the situation was that the FARC was characterizing these men as being prisoners of war, and it was really the U.S. government that was resistant to that. And I think in part it results from really a very genuine confusion about who these men were. They were actually contractors who were employed by a company called Northrop Grumman. And there was legitimate confusion over their status. They themselves weren't sure what their rights or obligations were. Were they obligated to attempt escape? There was just kind of generalized confusion over how these men who represented something of a new actor in conflict, where they fit in.
One of the things that I noted from that introduction was how we sort of blur the lines here because they are considered civilians. And there's a whole body of law that applies to how civilians get treated. And yet they were acting in a military capacity. And so how does international law deal with the civilian versus the military personnel in a case like this?
It's a gray area because, as you note, I mean, formally, they're civilians in part because they don't fall under the Geneva Convention's understanding of combatant. A combatant, of course, is someone who wears a distinctive uniform or symbol, carries arms openly, is part of a responsible hierarchical command, and complies with the laws and customs of armed warfare. Since most contractors don't meet at least one of those criteria, almost by default, they fall into the category of being civilians. Yet at the same time, if you look at the provisions in the Geneva Convention relating to civilians, civilians are really envisioned as taking no part in hostilities. So it's kind of strange because in a formal sense, they are civilians, but in a functional sense, they don't really occupy the position that we imagine civilians occupying. And in part, it's really a reflection of the fact that international law has done a great job with changes in armed conflict. And it was really around the middle of the last century that we saw a transition from international armed conflict being our kind of primary focus in terms of warfare to non-international armed conflict, civil wars, other types of internal conflict being really the focus. And what we saw some steps toward accommodating that with the protocols to the Geneva Conventions, international law as a whole really hasn't quite captured the fact that most of the people now doing the fighting and most of the casualties occur among people who are, in fact, formally civilians. So contractors are in some sense, the tip of the iceberg. We also have, of course, rebel movements. We have organizations that would be classified as terrorist groups or transnational criminal organizations. We have, in short, a lot of people who are kind of in this same gray area being very active in conflict.
So active in combat and yet still with a civilian status because they are not technically with a military. And so how do we deal with that in terms of international law? I wonder if we could back up a little bit. You did a little bit of history in terms of the prohibition of mercenaries that started back, I think you said it was 1794, and what brought that about. Why did the prohibition on mercenaries start?
Certainly. It's the case that private force isn't truly new in the international system. If we look back to the Middle Ages, we saw states utilizing private force in the forms of mercenaries and privateers, people who would be issued letters of marque and basically licensed to go out and attack enemy ships. And really, over time, states began to realize that while there were advantages to using non-state actors and entities that weren't formally part of the state military, there were also a lot of drawbacks, including, for example, the inability to really exert control over these entities and to kind of direct their actions. So we saw things like privateers attacking ships that were associated with allies of the state that was sending them out there. And we saw, you know, states, in effect, not really being able to exert control over the private parties who were acting on their behalf. So eventually, states began to make moves to marginalize those private actors. So we saw, for example, prohibitions on piracy, and the concept of privateering went away. And we saw states beginning to exert stronger control over their citizens, their nationals, and they're selling their services as mercenaries. So over time, you know, these entities really became marginalized within the international system. And of course, they never went away completely. Of course, we had, you know, mercenaries active during Cold War conflicts and wars of national liberation, but they really weren't significant. And it wasn't really until the end of the Cold War that we began to see private actors reemerging en masse in the form of these private military companies.
So what, in terms of international law, is currently in place in terms of prohibitions on, say, privateering or use of mercenary? Is there any such prohibition now?
There is a prohibition on mercenarism in international law, but in effect it's a prohibition that's very difficult to apply to people. It's a prohibition that has a number of different parts to it. So, you know, someone who's foreign to the conflict and motivated by profit, and a list of several other factors. And in essence, if someone's able to prove that they don't fit, you know, one or two of those pieces, then in effect they're not considered legally to be a mercenary. In response to the emergence of this new private market for force, states have taken some steps in the form of the Montreux document, which is essentially a document of best practices for states specifically that are hiring private military companies. But again, it's certainly not anything like a prohibition as such, which isn't really surprising because states want to be able to continue to employ private military companies, and they benefit from being able to hire them. So, you know, I think as long as that continues to be the case, we're not going to see states really taking strong steps to prohibit this type of activity.
Now, you mentioned that earlier the U.S. Neutrality Act and other concerns for neutrality were part of the international norm of not using private actors. How is it connected to neutrality?
The problem that we really faced at that point in time, and you know, around that time that we adopted the Neutrality Act, the U.S. was a new state. We weren't necessarily a very powerful actor in the system at that point in time. And really the fear was that, you know, Americans becoming involved in foreign conflicts by selling their services as mercenaries could potentially drag the U.S. into conflicts that we would prefer to avoid. So that was really the motivator behind the U.S. taking steps to limit the ability of Americans to participate in foreign conflicts and to sell their services as mercenaries is in some ways a reimagining of the relationship between state and citizen. It's the idea that the state could restrict its citizens from, in effect, engaging in warfare on their own behalf or on behalf of some other state.
It's interesting because it seems like there has been a turn in terms of some citizens acting now in private capacities, and maybe we should talk about some of those. I think a lot of us have heard about what happened in Iraq, especially with Blackwater, and we should recount some of that as well. But what I found particularly fascinating were some of the other means of private military contracting, including the young man you described who created a private military company in aid of Darfur to try to prevent genocide. So this is like multifaceted. Can you outline all of the different types of private military contractors, with like Blackwater perhaps being on one end of it, all the way down to somebody who created this in his dorm room?
You do get really a range of actors. I mean, the term private military companies encompasses just a range of different actors. And, you know, you see companies that are publicly traded, that are listed on the stock exchange, that are part of corporate conglomerates. And then you actually do find some companies that tend to be very small, very informal, kind of the equivalent of a mom-and-pop restaurant, if you will, except selling very different services. But, you know, certainly similar in terms of the opaque nature that we don't necessarily get to look at the books or get a lot of information about what it is that they're doing. And, you know, we see these companies performing a huge range of functions. I mean, certainly, you know, we do see companies engaging in the use of force on behalf of clients, Blackwater being perhaps one of those, and the defunct company Executive Outcomes, I think, being perhaps the best example. But we also see them really performing functions that are a little further removed from the combat field. We see them, for example, providing advice, training, consulting, and we see them performing also some functions that were once performed by the military, you know, setting up housing, tearing it down, cooking dinner, cooking meals, which, you know, we don't tend to necessarily think of those as being inherently military functions, but when you're able to kind of shift those functions to private actors, then it frees up more military personnel to perform those more central military functions. So it still very much has an effect on a state's capability to wage war because they're able to, in effect, multiply their force without enlarging the size of the military per se. Beyond the battlefield, and one of the things that I think people maybe don't notice as much is private military companies really providing expertise to us on issues and shaping the way that we see them, which I think is a really interesting and important function because, of course, they're motivated to frame issues as being military problems or security problems because those are the services that they provide. So just by way of example, one of the issues I talk about in the book is the problem of state failure. And the concept of state failure was really developed by an organization with ties to the private military industry. So while we might look at failed states like Somalia and see them as social problems or economic problems, kind of the impetus is really to see it as a security problem that requires some kind of military action. So we really see them performing a range of functions, both on the battlefield and off.
This idea that these private military companies can shift the thinking or the decisions to going to war or not, I also found really interesting, particularly in light of that the motivation could be profit-driven. So the push for thinking in these ways, reframing the ideas of when to go to war, why to go to war, coming from a sheerly profit perspective in some cases. Now, that was one example that you gave. Do you have a sense that there has been a success among some of these private military companies, contractors who would like to see more lethal activity for the bottom dollar?
I think we can see the influence of this kind of thinking. You know, for example, one place where contractors have been utilized is in the fight against piracy off the coast of Somalia and other places like that. You know, certainly there are other ways to approach the problem of piracy. You know, the people who are out there capturing ships and essentially holding the crew hostage until the insurance company pays out on the policy are really motivated by economics. They're not necessarily out there to cause harm to people or to wreak havoc or destruction. They're motivated, you know, strictly by the desire to earn some money. And, you know, we've seen, frankly, other states approaching the problem by paying them off, which is certainly one way to deal with the problem that doesn't involve the use of force or, you know, the deploying of security forces. So I think to some extent, I mean, we can kind of infer from our own response to piracy and to the employment of private military companies in that response, that this type of thinking and the securitizing, if you will, of issues does really have an impact.
Some of the other situations that you described in your book, I thought, were also new phenomena that we have not really given ample thought to. And a couple of them were conflicts that were going on in Africa. I think one was in Sierra Leone.
They can have a very dramatic effect on conflict, and I think Sierra Leone is a great way to cut into that. Sierra Leone was of course, a country that was embroiled in a civil war. At one point, the rebels had actually pulled within kilometers of the capital, Freetown, and the government, having been unsuccessful in trying to improve its own internal military capabilities, turned ultimately to the company Executive Outcomes. Executive Outcomes entered the conflict, and within a very short period of time, say under 100 days, they had completely reversed the strategic situation on the ground and had brought the rebels actually to the bargaining table. So I think that the Sierra Leone is indicative of the kind of really transformational effect that a private military company can have, even if they're not necessarily there in large numbers. But I think Sierra Leone is also something of a cautionary tale as well, because while Executive Outcomes was able to force the rebels to peace talks and ultimately a peace agreement did result from that, once Executive Outcomes left and its departure was in fact a term of the peace agreement, the peace fell apart very quickly and Sierra Leone was essentially right back where it was. So, you know, I think it's something of a cautionary tale that tells us that while private military companies can have a very significant strategic impact, that impact may not outlive their presence in the country.
Or it can make it worse, as was the case with Blackwater, which, as I recall, created a worse situation in Fallujah than what might have been. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't recount what happened with Blackwater.
Yeah, I think your assessment is correct that the U.S. military was drawn into Fallujah because of the attacks on Blackwater contractors there. And of course, we probably all recall seeing those rather horrifying images of the four Blackwater contractors having been burned and lynched in Fallujah. Yeah, it's not quite clear whether the people there necessarily knew that they were working for Blackwater, if they thought that they were perhaps working for the CIA or some intelligence agency, but certainly they were ultimately targeted and killed by elements within Fallujah. And as a result of that, the U.S. military, rather than being able to kind of avoid being drawn into Fallujah, was pulled in a very strong way.
It was also an example of a private military company personnel, the personnel acting out in ways that would be prohibited in terms of what military personnel would actually do. As I recall, and I think you cited in your book, the Congress did an investigation and found that the guards were opening fire in, I think it was nearly 200 occasions, and most of the time they were firing first.
Yeah, you're correct, and that was ultimately found to be the case in the very high-profile Nasir Square shootings, which was, of course, the shootings that took place at the Iraqi traffic circle, leaving 17 civilians ultimately dead. And while the Blackwater guards had stated that they were under fire, the subsequent investigation just really didn't bear that out. We did ultimately see some prosecutions in that instance, and people were convicted of those shootings. That's certainly not always the case, and really kind of the other high-profile instance from the Iraq War was Abu Ghraib, where half of the people involved in the detainee torture and abuse were, in fact, contractors from a couple of companies who were there as translators and linguists. And we saw a real divide in terms of what happened to the military personnel and what happened to the contractors. And every military person who was involved in Abu Ghraib was either court-martialed or forced to retire, whereas the contractors were simply pulled from Iraq and didn't really face any other consequences.
There were some similar types of violations, I think, in Afghanistan as well, weren't there?
Correct. There were allegations in particular that Armor Group had engaged in inappropriate conduct with respect to Afghanis, also inappropriate hazing conduct and so forth among themselves.
So these are some of the things that you were talking about in the context of just war theory, which has been sort of our international ethical document about when war is appropriate and how it should be conducted to avoid having wars go completely badly and immorally. So maybe we should back up a little bit and talk about the origins of just war theory and what it calls for in order to prevent complete and absolute immorality when it comes to conflict. So how did it begin and what are its tenets?
This is a tradition that really goes back as far as the ancient Greeks and perhaps really even earlier. And it's a tradition that has evolved over the centuries as warfare has changed. Really, since the rise of the national military, though, around the time of the French Revolution, we've really seen the just war tradition latching on to the political form of the state and really incorporating the state almost as an assumption. So it becomes difficult when we have actors in significant numbers who don't fit with that statist model. Just to kind of throw out a couple of ways that this really matters, one of our just war principles that helps to evaluate the decision to go to war is proportionality. In other words, is the war going to achieve more good than harm, or is it going to be disproportionately harmful? And this assumes that we have a good way to assess what the costs are, which, when you begin to incorporate private actors, isn't necessarily the case. To come back to the case of Iraq, at one point in time, we had essentially a one-to-one ratio of contractors to military personnel deployed in Iraq, so we had as many contractors as we had soldiers. Yet the casualty figures that the Pentagon would publish didn't include injuries or deaths among those contractors. So the information we were really given as the public was incomplete in terms of what the costs of the war actually were. And the deaths and injuries among contractors were more or less hidden in a way that kept the cost of the war artificially low. The government entity that was tracking casualties among contractors was actually not the Department of Defense. It wasn't the Pentagon. It was the Department of Labor. So kind of, a double standard, a disparate treatment where we count deaths and injuries to soldiers, and we're a little less aware of casualties among contractors, even though they're there in equal numbers. When we're making the decision about warfare, when we have public actors acting in concert with private actors, we don't necessarily always get a complete picture about what's happening. In terms of the conduct of the war, we also have those norms that tell us not just when it's justified, but also how it's justified, these use and bellow norms. And, you know, again, the assumption that we're dealing exclusively more or less with states is problematic because, you know, as we were talking about the contractors in Colombia, they kind of straddle that military-civilian divide, and they're really outside the structure of a hierarchical military. You know, U.S. Army Field Manual specifically states that military personnel cannot give orders to contractors, which really undermines the assumption we have that everyone participating in war is kind of part of the same hierarchical structure.
So there are a couple of things I was thinking. One pertains to the numbers that you were talking about, the distortion of the numbers dead. Now, one of our producers, Mike, mentioned this morning that Vladimir Putin had admitted, or at least some of the media had quoted him as admitting to using these private military people as an effort to keep the numbers, the official count, down. Do you think that this is something that is beyond Russia and going on in other countries so that they can keep the numbers hidden intentionally?
I think it's certainly the case. If you are aware that people are more invested in casualties among, you know, uniformed military than they are among contractors, then certainly using contractors in greater numbers, you know, does function to deflate the perceptions about casualties. People will think that that fewer people are dying and that the war is actually less costly than it is. But yes, I saw actually the same coverage that Putin has reportedly, you know, utilized private military both in Ukraine and in Syria.
The other issue is, of course, in democratic settings, the idea of having things under a public umbrella is that the public has some choice in the matter. Once you start privatizing things, it takes the public's say almost completely out.
It really does. You know, in particular, in this question of private military companies, you know, in some cases, there's very little public oversight. And if the contract is small enough, if it's under $50 million, there's not even necessarily legislative oversight of the decision to utilize private military companies. So it does pose a challenge, I think, to democracy. And I think, you know, one of the things that I came to realize as I was working on the book is that, you know, we're engaging in a conscious reversal in some ways of some of the institutional structures that are supposed to make democracies behave more peacefully in the international system. You know, Immanuel Kant, of course, wrote about this in his essay Perpetual Peace, and the argument in its simplest form is that if the people are faced with the burden of fighting a war or paying for a war, they're going to be less likely to fight unless the reason is really compelling. But if you're able to avoid sending your own citizens to war by utilizing private military companies, whether, again, it's one of your own country's companies or perhaps a foreign company, then you're, in effect, removing the incentive that people might have to very seriously deliberate about whether or not a war is a good idea.
And then that other piece that you were talking about earlier that comes into play, which is the influence of these private military companies on our norms and values, and the what we would call in the political communication studies is priming, the sort of criteria with which to make the decision, bringing some more to the forefront. And it sounds like what you're saying is that is going on, and particularly in the United States, at least.
I think that's certainly true. I mean, increasingly we turn to private military companies not just for their labor, but also for their expertise. And, you know, this happens especially in with regard to weapons systems that might be very technologically sophisticated. We may not have the expertise within the military to maintain those systems or to operate them. And we're also making use of private military companies for intelligence gathering. We're turning to them for their expertise in thinking about particular issues. There's kind of the expression out there that if you have a hammer, every problem is going to look like a nail. And, you know, we've kind of moved to the point now where we're turning to the hammer salesman for advice about what tool we should use. And, you know, they're beginning to point out, you know, all these additional nails that we hadn't necessarily noticed before.
So in context of just war theory, how are you proposing now to get this sort of under control so that we can try to go to a more ethical, moral model when it deals with international conflict?
Well, this is a tradition that is remarkably resilient. It's endured for centuries. So I think we can certainly, you know, begin to make just war arguments about wars in which private military are involved. I propose actually a two-pronged approach in the book, kind of divided along the lines of the jus ad bellum criteria that help us to think about when it's just to fight, and the jus in bello norms that apply to the question of how we go about fighting. And I think that when we take the jus ad bellum norms seriously, they function in a way to limit resort to force and to really be critical of a rush to war. And this requires really having a very complete assessment of what the ethical and strategic pictures look like. And I don't think you can achieve that in a privatized war unless you take account of both the public and private actors. So I think with respect to those questions, we really need to impute the actions and capabilities of private actors to state actors. Whereas if we're thinking about the question of how we fight, I think this is a scenario in which we can really have multiple parties bearing responsibility for action. So certainly we can hold individuals responsible for their conduct, and this is something actually that the U.S. has been moving to do in recent years through extending the Uniform Code of Military Justice to at least some of the contractors that we hire. But there's also room for responsibility on the part of companies that are employing individuals who may be, you know, committing acts that we think of as unethical or unjust. And potentially, I think there's also a degree of responsibility to be borne by the entities that might be hiring these companies as well, in particular if they continue to hire companies that have had problems in the past.
A couple of things. One is the when to go to war part, which, as I understand just war theory, is supposed to be completely contingent upon self-defense. Is that correct?
Just cause, the question of why you're fighting is really central to the way we think about the tradition today, and self-defense is certainly the archetypical just cause, although we certainly extend our thinking also to intervention when there are human rights violations as well.
The other question, when you're talking about the codes being extended to the private military contractors, would that mean that international laws such as Geneva Conventions and types of prohibitions and remedies could be applied to private contractors more readily?
Well, we've taken the step of kind of applying international norms through national mechanisms. So our Uniform Code of Military Justice actually mirrors international law very closely, and it's the law that is applied to our military personnel. And what Congress has done is it has extended the UCMJ to apply also to private contractors that are hired by the Department of Defense, which is by no means all the private contractors that the U.S. hires. The State Department, for instance, also makes extensive use of private military and security companies for protection details for embassy security and so forth. And some other executive agencies also hire them as well. So extending it to the Department of Defense contractors doesn't necessarily mean that we're applying the UCMJ to everyone, but we are applying it at least to a significant portion of the contractors that the U.S. hires.
And then finally, you had noted very early in the book about how this use of the private military companies has grown tremendously from the Cold War all the way up until today. There were some pretty large numbers. Do you see that trend continuing, or do you see it tapering off? Can you get a sense of what is happening?
I think that we're seeing the raw numbers, at least that the U.S. is utilizing, falling a little bit because, of course, we're winding down major conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think, you know, the extent to which we continue to utilize them will depend in part in terms of, you know, what develops in the international system. I think that to the extent that there's conflict in the system, there will be continued extensive use of contractors. And of course, you know, we're by no means the only employer of these companies. Certainly other states employ them, and we even see other actors, even other corporations, hiring private companies as well. So certainly I think the industry is not going away anytime soon. And I think that if we see you know, conflicts continuing to erupt and to grow, we're going to continue to see very extensive use of private contractors as well.
I was surprised to see they were, in some cases, used almost as the exclusive armed forces in some countries, and also, in some cases, as peacekeepers.
It's true. I mean, we even see international organizations like the UN hiring them, although they're also, you know, very critical of the private military industry at the same time. And in particular, I mean, we utilize contractors for a number of reasons, perhaps political purposes, that we want to be able to, you know, kind of send some troops under the radar, so to speak, or we believe that it's going to be a more efficient solution than sending the public military. But if there absolutely are states that are truly dependent on the private military industry to perform security functions, you know, there are some states that really are forced to privatize out of necessity. They don't have a national military that can meet their needs. They don't have allies that are willing to meet their needs. And so they've effectively got no choice, really, but to turn to the market.
Well, Amy Eckert, thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle again.
It was my pleasure.
Amy Eckert is a professor of political science at the Metropolitan State University of Denver, where she teaches and studies international ethics and international law. And her books include The Future of Just War, Rethinking the 21st Economy, and the latest, which we've been talking about, Outsourcing War, the Just War Tradition in the Age of Military Privatization. Thank you so much.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.